Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Odyssey is giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor.
Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app.
Thanks to Republic Records.
This is a national contest.
The loudest, the biggest, the brashest. New York is its own character in every play.
The bad thing about New York is the pressure. You're always under pressure.
Here are the stories about those plays. It's New York Accent with Damon Amendola.
So I'm on my back, and I'm stretching, and here comes Bill. And I'm saying, oh, boy, what's going to happen here now? So he comes over, and he has a bat in his hand, of course. And he stands over me and he says, hey, Mookie, hey, you want to hit some ground ball?
Was that a joke or was that a peace offering?
No, I don't. This is verbatim is how it happened.
Wow.
Verbatim. And I thought it was just so weird for him to, if I had said that to him, it would have been an insult.
As he walked to the plate on October the 25th, 1986, the New York Mets were going to lose the World Series. By the time he had sprinted to first base, they had won it. It's not hyperbole to say Mookie Wilson's frantic, heart-wrenching, miraculous at-bat in Game 6 of the World Series is the most important in New York baseball history. When the ball went through Bill Buckner's legs, Shea Stadium shook like an earthquake had just hit Queens, and the Mets were certain to clinch their rings in Game 7. 37 years later, it's still the last championship the Mets have won. He never even made an All-Star game, and yet he's by far one of the most popular and significant players in New York sports history. His first name, Mookie, rained down from the upper deck with every base hit and stolen base. He was the OG of that 86 Mets team, the first piece put in place 6 years earlier, so he saw the whole evolution from losers to winners. He always wore a smile and yet had his own feuds and disappointments with management. The 1986 Mets live in lore, not just here in New York, but in baseball in general. Mookie was a straight arrow on a team full of bent, broken, late-night carousing scoundrels. So the stories about how he fit in are fascinating. And as a Mets fan myself, who considers the 86 team to be his spirit animals, I had no idea of the deep and lasting relationship Mookie had with the emotionally tortured Bill Buckner that they developed over the years until I spoke to him. Mookie essentially became Buckner's confidant. And Mookie married the mother of his brother's son, who would become Major League Baseball hitter Preston Wilson. One of the most fascinating careers in this city's sports history. This is Mookie Wilson's New York accent. Mookie, how you doing?
I'm doing just fine. You know, sitting here in the nice warm weather in the Carolinas, doing great.
Well, you grew up in South Carolina. Is this true that you got the nickname Mookie because of how you pronounced milk when you were a kid?
I don't want to burst anyone's bubble, but that's not true.
Okay, so that's an old wives' tale. How did you get the nickname?
In all honesty, I have no idea. And no one else knows. I don't think that anyone in my family who has nicknames know where they come from because everyone has nicknames. It's just something that my family does, sometimes no particular reason, just something might have happened way back when I was little, so who knows, but no one claims credit for it, so hey, it is what it is.
That's amazing. So one of the most famous first names slash nicknames in New York sports history, and the origins are just lost to the Wilson family decades ago, huh?
It is. I mean, it's amazing. I would love to have a nice, interesting story to tell people. You know, for instance, if you call someone shorter, usually it means just tall or with short, whatever, the opposite. Yeah. But this has no particular meaning. No one else in the family has a nickname named Mookie. So who knows? Who knows?
It's actually kind of better that way to have some mystique and mystery around the nickname Mookie. You know, I think a lot of Mets fans and New York fans in general, baseball fans, know that you're a really popular guy, that you've always done great things in the community. Seems like you've always had a lot of outreach towards fans. But when I saw this story, it really took me back about the type of caliber person that you are, that your brother had a child when you were playing in the minor leagues, and unfortunately, he was unable to support that child. And you stepped in and married the mother of that child. I wonder how extraordinarily rare that decision is, and how did that come to pass?
Well, I think it's, you know, it might be rare, but it's not, you know, it's not something that's never happened before. And it was an interesting story, very interesting. But, you know, and most of it is fairly accurate, but the bottom line is I did marry the mother, you know, of the child. The fact of the matter was that the mother was once married to my brother at one point. So I think that sometimes that gets lost in the translation of the whole story, you know. So, you know, and they were both young, very young at the time. I think she, you know, had the child when she was like 16, something of that nature, whatever. It's an interesting story, well known where I live and stuff like that, but where culturally things may not be accepted a lot of times, and sometimes that causes issues and problems. But no, we had no issues. We had no problems. I mean, no initial shock, but other than that, family is very close, and we remain that way.
Did that help strengthen the bond between you and your brother? Did it create distance? What were the dynamics?
No, it didn't go either way, because we were very close all the time. And, you know, relationships don't always work out. Okay. I think today's society might be even harder for relationships to work out. And at that point, like I said, they had married really young. And neither one of them was ready for marriage, to be honest with you. But, you know, some 6 and 7 years later, they just, you know, they parted ways, you know. And, you know, I was the lucky one. I was just there. And one thing led to another, and then we became a family. You know, it sounds simple, but it really, that's what it is.
And you remained married to her for the rest of your career. And that young boy turned into Preston Wilson, who was a Major League Baseball player.
Yeah.
I mean, boy, talk about happy endings for something that is so unique. Yeah. It all really turned out well, didn't it?
Yeah, it turned out really well. Like I said, we were always close, you know, as a family. And, I took him everywhere I went. I took him everywhere I went. You know, and it was just us. We just had a great, great relationship. I mean, he was really, really young. You know, when I married his mom, he was really young. He like 4 years old. So he don't, you know, yeah, I'm probably the only dad he's ever known. So, and that's the way it is today. That's the beginning and the end. It's just been a really, really, really good relationship for me. It's worked out for me. It's worked out for everyone. And we've been married now for about 44 years. So it's been awesome.
Man, that speaks to your character. It speaks to your whole family's character. 44 years, and Preston had such a successful career himself. Yeah. That is so amazing. So you end up with the New York Mets. You had gotten drafted by the Dodgers earlier, decided not to sign, drafted for the Mets. And early on, you're known for your defense and your speed, and you're making your way through the minors. You get to the majors, and you're really one of the faces of the Mets, but there's a lot of losing early in the 80s. How was that to kind of endure being the best player or one of the best players, but a team that really couldn't get over the hump and had 90 plus losses every year.
It was disappointing. I was one of probably one of many ball players who think that when they get to the big leagues or to a team that they're going to make a difference. You know, they're going to end their losing ways and all of a sudden things are going to be peachy. That wasn't the case. I have won on every team I've been on. I mean, minor league clubs, we won. College teams, we won. High school team, we won. So I had no reason to believe that going to major leagues would be any different. But I was wrong. I was so wrong. You know, it was disappointing. But I enjoyed the game so much that losing was just part of things you had to endure. I think those early years actually helped me accept Major League Baseball better because, you know, you can get a little bit arrogant when you win everywhere you go, and then all of a sudden you lose and you don't know how to take it. You know, I had to learn how to lose. Believe it or not, I had to learn how to lose. And it made me a better person, taught me how to accept failure and how to accept, because let me tell you, the fans in New York let you know when you're going bad. They let you know.
Yeah.
But they've always treated me very well. You know, win or lose, they've always treated me the same. So I've learned a lot about that.
Was there culture shock when you got to New York? Being from South Carolina, getting to New York City, and as you said, hearing some of the boos?
There's a lot of shock. Like I said, I've always been cheered everywhere I've gone. I didn't know what a boo sounds like until I got to New York. You know?
That's a great quote.
I had no idea. But, you know, it was good. And after a while, I learned that they weren't booing me personally. There was never anything personal about the boos. It's all about, you know, when we win, they win. When we lost, they lost. And they felt the pain that we felt as, you know, as professional athletes and just failing, you know. And I guess they had been losing for some years and they're a little bit fed up with it, you know. And so I understood that, but I also understood that that my profession was to play baseball and was to entertain people. And that's what I tried to do, regardless of the outcome.
You guys lost more than 90 games in 80. 81 was strike shortened, but 82, 83. Couldn't get over the hump of that 500 mark. But then finally in 84, things start to turn. Do you remember a moment, a player, a game, a series where you said, oh, you know what? Okay, finally, we're on the right track.
There's no one game, but I did see a change. Started to happen actually in 83. And in 84, those changes began to see positive results for that change. We were still losing late 83, but we were more competitive. We were in games. We had a chance to win a lot of games. And I couldn't say that the first couple of years. We didn't have a chance. We had no chance whatsoever. We were just trying to make it through the season without losing 100. That was all we were trying to do. But when you start to see the progress, it was fun. It was even fun. Even when you lost, you know, you felt good about things. In 84, it was a little early, but we really had a legitimate shot in 84, you know. And that's when everything started really coming around. There was no more, well, when we, you know, get a little more experience. Those days were gone. We had the experience. Now it was time to put it together. And we had started putting it together.
Daryl turned into a star. Keith was traded for. Yeah. A lot of people point to Gary Carter as that final piece to make you guys a championship team in 85. Did you feel like Gary Carter was that final piece?
In all honesty, Gary was a great player, And having him on the club was nothing but positive. But in my mind, and for what I had thought, what I seen, I thought that we had to make up a championship club before we got Gary. I think Gary just put a stronger person in a position that we were probably somewhat weak at. And that put us, you know, definitely took away all the guesswork then at all. But I thought that we had enough before we got Gary. But getting Gary was definitely made things easy for everybody. Everybody.
You're building an 84, you're building an 85. By 86, there's real championship aspirations, but your spring training is cut short. Rafael Santana throws a ball from 40 feet away in spring training, hits you right in the eye. Luckily, you have glasses on, but shatters the glasses and you are injured. Was there ever any fear that you had lost eyesight in that eye?
That was, that might have been the most frightening moment of my life, not career, of my life. Because at that moment, I wasn't even thinking about baseball. I mean, baseball was the last thing I was thinking about. I was concerned about being able to see, you know. And, you know, I didn't know what to have, what to think, because they had the eye covered for a while and it was just total darkness on that side. So I had no idea what was going on, and the anxiety there was, it was tough. It was tough getting through. And I didn't know if I wanted to know or didn't want to know. I just didn't want to know what the results were. But fortunately, everything turned out okay. But yeah, there was some fear there. But it was all about my eyesight more so than playing the game.
Those have got to be, were those hours that you worried about, that days? How long was it that you really worried about?
It was days, yeah.
Man. So then you end up missing the rest of spring training and the first month of the season, but you guys are off to the races. Then you come back in May and the team is just a wagon. It's impossible to stop. And it's just kind of a rollicking summer where you guys dominate the National League East. Nobody can take you down. And it almost feels like you guys know we're so good. We'll beat anybody and we know we will beat you. Yeah. What was the feeling of dominance of that entire summer of 86?
You know, I don't know if that was better or to go through the season with the mystery of not knowing what was going to happen. We went through that season. It wasn't a matter of if we were going to beat you, it was just how bad we were going to beat you.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and we approached every game with a swagger, arrogance. There's no other way to put it. I thought that at times we probably, I think that's why teams really hated us a lot, because we were just arrogant. It wasn't the confidence anymore. We were past the confidence stage. We were arrogant. You know, it is what it is. We were arrogant, you know, but we were that good. We had no weaknesses. That's the point. We had no weaknesses. And so no one could say, well, if we do this, we could shut them down. We throw a left hand at them. No. We had an answer for everything they threw at us. You know, and set loose fog. They tried it. It just didn't work.
That doesn't seem to fit, though, with your personality. You're a pretty humble guy. I don't feel like you've ever been an arrogant guy. So was it hard for you to fit into a group of guys in a team dynamic that seemed to be really brash, really out there, and really outspoken?
Yeah, it was totally different from what I was always taught. You know, my father taught me a lot of times, you know, just, you know, be a graceful winner and even more graceful when you lose, you know. And you never want to rub people's noses in anything. You never celebrate other people's failures. Now, I don't think he was talking about baseball game when he said all that. But, it did come to mind is that, yeah, we beat you and we're going to beat you. But it's no need in us bragging about it. Well, at some point we did some things that probably appeared that we were boastful. We really were bragging about it. And just the way we stepped on the field a lot of times, some of the things that we did, and it was totally against what, you know, I would have done personally, but man, it was fun. I'm not going to lie. It was fun.
I don't blame you. It looked really fun for the outside. But we all know the excesses of the 80s, New York City, celebrity, young people, that team, money, alcohol, women, all of that type of stuff. Did you ever feel during that season or any time during the 80s, whoa, this is getting a little out of control for these guys?
Well, not during the season. During the season, winning took precedence over everything. It really did. Winning took precedence over everything because you know, after losing so many years, I mean, a lot of young guys didn't know what it meant to lose. They didn't know what it felt like to lose. I did. I did. So, you know, we deserve to win and enjoy it. We deserved it. We earned that. But there came a point when, yeah, you know, maybe we ought to cut back on, you know, some of the things that were going on. But then again, those were the personalities. And that's the one thing. And I believe that to this day. When you stop a person from being himself, then you ask the person to change. But part of who he was his personalities away from the game. You know, and you expect them to have that same personality on the field. And, you know, sometimes it's just not possible. Some players just can't do that. They just can't. They struggle with it. That team didn't have an issue with it because they were loose cannons, man. They did and felt what they, you know, what made them happy at the time. But the good part about it was when they came to the ballpark, it was business. It was all business. And that I admired.
Seemed like there was certainly a social group on that team that would always go out together and do their thing. Who was your closest friend on the team that you spent time with?
I spent time, it was two guys, Rafael Santana and Tim Tuffle. We, you know, we spent more time together than anybody else. The rest of it was a little bit different. I think that, I don't know if those two guys understood me better and they were more comfortable around me. I knew that I was more comfortable around them. And it was just, you know, nothing that was just, it just happened. You know, we just became very close and we did a lot together.
How about the twist of fate that it's Rafi who throws the ball that smashes your eye? He must have felt so awful that it was him that threw that baseball.
Well, I know that, and believe it or not, we never talked about it. Because, you know, number one, most responsibility blame was on me because of what I did, you know. And how the story goes, let's explain it, you know. We're in the rundowns in spring training, and they were saying, okay, last run, pitchers pick off, get out, you know, pitchers. It's work out for the pitchers, really. It wasn't for the base runner. It's for the pitchers. So I'm going to be somewhat of a devil. I'm going to say, I'm going to get out of this rundown and make us do it again. That's how it.
Oh, really? Really?
That's how it all started. Okay. That's how it all started. So I went out and I was, instead of going through the motions and just let them do their thing, I was going to get out of rundown. So I was going to use one of my patented moves, you know.
Okay.
And when I turned around, the ball met me halfway, you know. So it was a really, really tough. But Rafi felt bad about it. And you say 40 feet away, it was closer than 40 feet.
Yeah.
It was really, really, really close, you know. But, you know, he felt bad about it. And, you know, things turned out well, though. And I'm happy for him because I know Rafi. And he would have been really, really just heartbroken if things hadn't turned out the way they did. Yeah. But we were really close and Tuffle as well. So we really had a lot in common.
108 wins. You guys dominate the National League East, dominate the entire league in general, race to the division crown, meet the Houston Astros in the NLCS. It's one of the great postseason series of all time. But for some reason, one of the best teams in the modern era could not hit Mike Scott. To this day, Scott will say, did nothing wrong, but you tell me. And to God, was Mike Scott doctor in that baseball that year?
Well, you know, I know Scott. Scotty was my teammate in AAA, so I played with Mike quite a bit. And Mike was a power pitcher, fastball. He always had the fastball. Had a very mediocre breaking ball, which probably kept him from being, you know, a dominant pitcher because you have to be able to have command, you know, or at least two good pitches. But when he went over and he learned whatever that he learned. I don't know what that he learned. Whether you call it, what you're going
to
call it.
It's a good way to put it. Learn whatever you learned.
Yeah, whatever you learned. But he was very effective to go, you know. And it wouldn't have been as effective, but see, he had another pitch that was really good. That was his fastball. He had a good fastball. And most many pitchers would tell you, most good coaches would tell you that everything comes off the fastball. You know, everything starts with the fastball. No, he shouldn't admit anything. I mean, why would he? You know, but the fact of the matter is, whether he did or not, psychologically, he was in the heads of a lot of the players on our team. He was in the head. He was in their head. And, that was not working in our favor. So I'm glad it ended in six games, because the seventh game would have been a very, very interesting game.
Game six was a titanic tilt back and forth of the Astrodome.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how you guys survived that emotionally. I can't believe anybody survived that, but you guys finally do outlast the Astros, game six of the Astrodome, and now you're headed back to New York knowing you're going to the World Series. And that plane ride now lives in lore. What was the plane ride like between Houston and New York after clinching the National League?
Well, that plane ride was it was a good ride, and I'm gonna give you my spin on it, and you can ask some other players. Okay. But to come out of Houston in that game, all bets are off after that, man. Because I tell you what, we survived the toughest challenge we've had all year. That's the one time I can say that we were challenged. We hadn't been challenged all year until that series. That series challenged us, and we knew it. And we knew it. We felt it. We knew that was a challenge. And to come out of that, I think the celebration is more of relief than anything else. Because, you know, I was nervous. I mean, my chest was hurting. I was glad the game was over. My chest was literally aching. You know, just from the anticipation, the anxiety of the whole game. I've never felt like that in any ball game I've been playing. I've been playing a long time. That's the only ball game that I ever felt nervous about, was that game. And to come out of it, yeah, whatever happened to the plane ride, and I won't tell you what happened to the plane ride, it was well earned.
So you guys dropped the first two of the World Series of the Red Sox. Do you think that there was an emotional hangover because of everything you went through to beat the Astros in game six and then coming into the World Series?
No question. In my opinion, I think that we were just, you know, we waste so much energy, emotionally and physical energy, against the Astros. And we felt that we had beat the only team that could challenge us. And I believe that we went into the Red Sox game just flat, just, you know, saying, oh, we can handle these guys. Not a big deal, you know. And because we look at it from top to bottom, we just didn't see the challenge. We did not see the challenge there. And I think we were just too flat, you know. And to lose those two games, reality set in, you know, hey, we about to lose this thing, you know, and we picked it up.
Picked it up big time, tie the series up, and it takes us to the iconic game six, where, again, you find yourselves down. It's an unfamiliar role because you had dominated the entire season, but here are the Red Sox, and out away from clinching a World Series championship in your house at Shea Stadium in the 10th inning of game number six. You said your heart was tight. Your chest was tight in game six of the NLCS. Was it tight at this point as well?
No. It's one thing to be challenged by a team that you knew was going to challenge you. I was more disappointed with the Boston game than anything else, because we had let our guard down with the Red Sox. Plain and simple. We let our guard down. And they snuck up on us, you know, surprisingly. So we had nobody to blame but ourselves on that part. You know, not to mention that game, they had one of the best pitchers in the game throwing that game, Roger Clemens, you know. So, you know, we shouldn't have gotten to that point, you know. With Houston, it was a different story. We went in there, man. We were putting everything in line when we went out there, and they still took us to the task, man. You know, Boston was a little bit different. In Houston, it was a little bit of fear. In Boston, it was more disappointing.
You are now at the plate for two of the most important plays in franchise history, and you could argue in baseball history. The first is, there's two outs, there's a runner on third base, and you guys are still down a run.
Yeah.
Bob Stanley on the hill, and you get out of the way of a wild pitch, dive out of the way, tying run scores. Did you have a feeling going into that at bat that Stanley was going to be wild and you should look out for pitches in the dirt like that?
No. I went into that at bat knowing that Stanley, his out pitch was a sinker. You know, ground ball pitcher, this is what he wanted. And I know that most sinkers are going to be out of half the plate. So basically, I went there and said, hey, I'm going to take that away from him. I'm going to hit that outside pitch. I'm cheating, basically, what I'm doing. I'm cheating. I'm looking away. I'm going to hit anything that he throws out. It can be 3 inches, 4 inches, 5 inches off the plate. I'm swinging at it, which no secret, I did that anyway. So I don't know why I was playing it out. That's something I did anyway. But there was never fear about my being able to hit him. It was just what the outcome, you know, and stuff of that nature. So when he threw the ball inside, and I've watched that many, many, many times. And if I don't jump out of the way, I don't know if that ball hits me if I just stand still. I really don't know if that ball hit me. But the point that I was cheating away, looking away so hard that I panicked a little bit when it came inside. And even the catcher, normally a catcher, he catches that ball. So he must have looking away too as well. So
that's a great point.
Yeah.
That's a great point. It gets by, you dive out of the way, tying run scores. Oh my goodness, Shea Stadium is rocking. We've got a tie ball game, game six, and the life is back for the New York Mets. At this point in time, at the very least, you've extended the game going to another inning, and yet there's one more iconic play to go.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Odyssey is giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor. Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app.
Thanks to Republic Records.
This is a national contest.
All right, now I'm going to read to you the transcript of the legendary Vin Scully on NBC Sports calling one of the most iconic plays and moments in baseball history. So the winning run is at second base with two out, 3-2 to Mookie Wilson. Little roller up along first, behind the bag, gets through Buckner. Here comes Knight, and the Mets win it. What do you remember?
Okay, let's back up before we get to the bag. Okay, we get way ahead of this thing here. Back up a little bit.
You want to dissect it every inch? I'm here for it.
First of all, after the wild pitch, I'm playing with house money now.
right.
I'm playing with house money right now. And whatever bet you had down, forget them. I'm playing with house money right now, baby. So, hey, I'm in the driver's seat now. Okay, that's first of all. Okay. The question you asked me about what I do when I hit the bag, all the emotions that I had happened before I got to the bag. First of all, it was a very good pitch for me to hit. Ball is down, middle end, you know, well, middle half the plate down. That's a left-hander's dream. And the pitch right where I'm looking anyway, down, you know, and I rolled over it. All right. First of all, that's a bad swing. When you take a bad swing, I don't know if you ever played in baseball or anything like that. As you take a bad swing, or you play golf, when you take that bad swing, you play that bad swing, and you don't always say good words. All right. So that's the first thing. I took a bad swing. All right. So we won't say what I said. Use your imagination. Okay.
Okay.
Use your imagination. Now the ball is hit, and the ball is hit so slow, I got nothing to do but run. That's what I'm known for. I got to run. I've always run. So that's no big deal. But the ball's hit so slow. It looked like it took 5 minutes for that ball to get there. And when it went between his legs, I said them same words again.
Really?
I said it again.
Oh, complete.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He missed it. No, no. Okay. But you're ruining my reputation now. Okay. But anyway.
It was oblique angry and then oblique excited the second
time. Okay. All right. And, but when I hit, when I got to second base, you know, the first base, you notice I'm going to second base. Why am I going to second base? The game's over.
Yeah.
The game's over. But anyway, so that everything happened before I got to the bank. You know, I didn't stop until I got to second base.
I want you to know that you've said this, but I believe it. Even if Buckner fields that ball, I absolutely am convinced you beat him to the bag anyway. Yeah. I mean, he's also, his momentum's kind of carrying him backwards a little bit. Obviously, his knees weren't that good. Yeah. I think you're still getting that bag no matter what. What do you think?
Bill and I have had this conversation many times. Many times. We have talked about it, and we actually sat there and watched the game together and dissected the whole inning, Bill and I. And we both agreed that even if he catched the ball, he said, I don't think I'll beat you to the bag even if I catch the ball because of the momentum and where he was so far off the line. He's going away and back. So he don't know, but at the moment, I couldn't. The pitcher is out of play. I don't. The pitcher got no chance. The pitcher, which is another conversation you can have a lot about. But the pitcher's out of play. Maybe he thought that down the line was an easy play for the first baseman. Well, the first baseman was out of position. But even if he catches the ball, I stand by my beliefs and not without talking with the other guy who was involved that I would have beaten to the bank.
It's amazing that you spent so much time with Bill Buckner after that, whether it was card shows, autograph signings, documentaries, what have you. Was it ever hard to be with him since he became such a pariah in Boston and because he always wore the goat horns after that?
Never. It was the first day we got together was difficult. But the first day we got together, initially we started doing some private things for a company, which was Steiner Sports at the time. And we never went into public. And then when we decided to go into public, we talked about it and we both agreed that we were going to do it. Even if one person had a request, he would not accept without the consent of the other. And that's the kind of relationship we had. He would call me and say, hey, man, I got this opportunity. You know, you want to do it? Blah, blah, blah. Okay, Bill. And then I would call him and say, Bill, I got this opportunity. You know, you want to do it? He'd say, in New York? Yeah, in New York, blah, blah. He came to Shea Stadium a couple of times, you know, and did some things together. So we developed this just great, great relationship. And it was something that I don't know if any two people that weren't teammates could be any closer. Than Bill and I. And I love telling the story how we got together. I was playing in Toronto after I got traded, and he was with Kansas City. And I was down the right field line, stretching down the right field, the left field line, because the batting cages for Kansas City was down the left field line. And I see him coming across the ball field, going to the batting cages. So I'm running the center field to keep him talking to the guy. You know, I didn't want to talk to the guy. I hadn't spoken to him. I had never spoken to the guy other than, you know, how you doing at first base.
But and this is five or 6 years later, right? This is by 91?
This is 89.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So I'm saying, okay, like I can't meet this guy, so I'm going to center field. You know, keep doing my sprint. Normal. That's normal. Big deal. But for some reason, he got detained. I don't know who stopped him, but I ended up back on the line stretching. So I'm on my back, and I'm stretching. And here come Bill. And I'm saying, oh, boy, what's going to happen here now? So he comes over me and has a bat in his hand, of course. And he stands over me and he says, hey, Mookie, hey, you want to hit some ground balls? And from that moment, we just been
that. Was that a joke or was that a peace offering?
This is verbatim is how it happened.
Wow.
Verbatim. And I thought it was just so weird for him to, if I had said that to him, it would have been an insult.
Totally.
Said, yeah.
And you guys weren't teammates. It wasn't like opponents go out before games and work on ground balls together.
No. And he asked me to hit him some ground balls. And I'm saying, but that's the kind of guy he was. And there are many other instances that we had conversation, nothing to do with baseball whatsoever, all family matters and whatever. He would call me in the middle of the night sometime, just call and we would talk, you know. And but he was just, he just became one of my closest friends. Yeah.
Wow. So maybe what that was him trying to process all of what had happened with you. And boy, he found a kindred spirit. I mean, you're a kind guy. You're easy to talk to. You're warm. I mean, that must have meant the world to him that he had you. If it was going to happen versus anybody, that he had you in that, that must have been a very special bond that you both had. If he's going to call you in the middle of the night.
Yeah, we had a lot more in common than anybody would believe. He called me a couple of times. He was doing some speakings. He's a very religious guy. People don't know that. And he would call me because he found out I was a minister. And he would call me and ask me for Bible scripture, you know, to recite to the young boys or the kids that he was going to be, you know, talking to and stuff like that. So we had all those kind of things, all those kind of conversations that people just don't, you know, don't realize. And he would call me, you know, hey, I'm going hunting, man. You know, Bill, if it's under 40 degrees, I ain't going. Don't even call me. But he loved elk hunting. So he loved going to snow hunting elk and stuff like that. Nah, Bill, not today. He would catch trout. He would send me photos of trout because he knew I loved fishing and stuff. We just had so much in common. We had a lot in common. Yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah. Well, it seals game six for you. I mean, Shea Stadium is rocking off of its foundation at this point in time. It might just fall down. And you guys end up going to game number seven. And I don't think there was ever any doubt, even though the Red Sox jumped out early on you guys, it never felt like there was any chance that you could lose game seven. Even when you guys were down to that game, was there any doubt that you would close it out and win the World Series after game six?
No, after game six, game seven was just a formality. And even when the Red Sox were up, you could look in the dugout and you can tell they were nervous, man. They had no fight left in them, man. Yeah. And that's what I do a lot of times. I always look at the opposing dugout. You can tell. I do that. And they were just waiting for the other shoe to fall. That was it.
So you win the World Series in 86, and it is everything. Mets fans haven't tasted this since the 1969 season. New York as a city has fallen in love with you guys. You're the talk of the town. And as we just said, there's excesses there in the city in the 80s. What is it like after you win the World Series that winter, that offseason, and going forward? Because now you're the world champion, 86 Mets.
It was going forward. It was just excitement everywhere you go. As a matter of fact, my name changed. They started calling me Mookie 86. I didn't have a last name after that. Mookie 86. Mookie 86. I know you. You Mookie 86. So yeah. Okay. But it was great. The city was great. Not only in New York, everywhere I went, everywhere you go. That was a series for baseball lovers all over the world. It wasn't just New York. It was just a great, great, great time, man. And you know, I enjoyed it. I mean, it was a lot of fun. And I finally understand how baseball affects people's lives. When you're in a region, you know how to affect New Yorkers' lives, but everybody's lives. It's just amazing. And winning in 86 helped us do that.
Did you feel, and do you still feel like you're the OG of the 86 Mets, that you were the first building block for that championship team?
Yeah. I felt. But you know, at times you feel like you're going to be on outside looking in because they're bringing in so many young faces, different faces and stuff like that. And they became more dependent on those guys as you did, with you. And, sometimes your ego can take a little beating, you know, and stuff like that, but yeah.
Well, the front office traded away Kevin Mitchell, Lenny Dykstra,
yes,
Roger McDowell, Wally Backman, Ray Knight, left in free agency. I mean, it was just a constant parade.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that tinkering and those maneuvers kind of ruined the chemistry of what you guys had?
I feel that way. I believe that way. And I say it from day one. It's not always about the physical ability of the players. Because let's face it, Ray Knight, Kevin Mitchell, all those guys, and the other, you know, you probably could find guys with more physical ability. Kevin McReynolds probably was a more physical ball player than Kevin Mitchell, talent-wise. But he didn't, there was something missing there that Kevin Mitchell had that he did not have, you know, and stuff like that. So, yeah, you know, that was the beginning of destruction of that 86 team.
It's a tough one to watch get disassembled because what the front office is trying to do is stay young and probably take out what they thought were some of the problem children of that clubhouse. And, you know, maybe part of the reason you guys were so good in 86 is because of some of the problem children. Is it possible that was a help?
Well, I think that management has to worry about two things. That is winning ball games and culture of the club. And I think that they felt that they had enough talent, so let's work on the culture part of it. And that part didn't work either. That backfired. Because we still had a pretty good club. We still had a pretty good club. After 89, we still had a pretty good club. But we didn't have enough to get us over the hump. So what is missing there?
It's never quite the same. 87, you guys fall short. 88, you get to the NLCS. Yeah. You dominated the Dodgers all season long.
Yeah.
10-11.
I know.
And then you get to the NLCS and lose the NLCS. What was the difference in the postseason versus the regular season against the Dodgers?
Playoff baseball is different. On any sport, the playoffs is different. You have to have a certain tenacity to win in the playoffs. You can't be just good. All right. You have to push yourself beyond being good. And you got to put some fear in the other club, something that knowing that they can't beat you, you know. and I think that we just didn't have that. We got hit in the mouth and we just didn't get up off the floor. That's just what happened. We just didn't get up.
In 89, again, you guys are chasing, but unfortunately you'll fall short of the postseason before the trade deadline. You are dealt to the Toronto Blue Jays. Yeah. Jeff Musselman and Mike Brady come back. Yeah. Did that hurt to leave the only franchise you'd ever known?
It did, but I had asked for a trade the year before, and they said they wasn't going to do it. So I put that out of my mind. But I asked for a trade, not wanting to leave New York. It was really more of a play me or trade me. Well,
because there's so many outfielders where you are at that point in time in your career.
You know, it was evident that I was being phased out because you brought in Juan Samuel to play center field. Come on. That was, that's when you know the writing's on the wall. They passed me now. And whatever happens, but that's what the sport is. That's what it is.
A couple of years later, you end up retiring. At that point in time, were you satisfied and complete in your career? Or did you feel like there was still more to go, but maybe your body wasn't there where you wanted it to be?
I definitely felt I had more years left, but I needed time to get my body ready to for that long season. I had a shoulder injury that just lingered that whole year in Toronto. And I was not able to play. I just wasn't able to play. But when you're the age I was and you sit out, there's no coming back. You don't come back after that. You know, you have to constantly stay out there and put it together. And I wasn't able to do it. So I was happy with my accomplishments. I was not happy the way I left the game, but I understood because, I had an opportunity to go to spring training with somebody, in AAA in minor league. But at my age, I wasn't going back in minor league. Nah, I wasn't doing that.
Yeah. I always found your story also post-baseball to be amazing because you always have had such a positive outlook and push forward and want to do more. And after baseball, look, you could have done a lot of things, but you decided I wanted to go get my education. So you went back to school. And you got your degree from Mercy College. Then you got your commercial driver's license as well.
Yes.
Did you end up using that driver's license?
I drove truck until last December.
Really?
Yeah, I just gave it up last December.
You're kidding.
I gave it up because, the grandkids, I want to spend more time with the grandkids. and stuff like that. And I just wanted to be able to do more with them. It was really a good gig because the company, well, I had my own company at one point, and then that year, like 2007-08, the economy got bad, so I sold everything. And then I started driving for another company, and they gave me the luxury of driving and still working in New York at the same time. So, yeah, it worked out really, really good. They enjoyed the second best job I've ever had was driving a truck.
Is that right?
Yes.
Wow. What'd you love about it?
The peace. The peace and just, you know, the only thing that you work against is time. That's it. You know, I just love that. Matter of fact, I wrote my book while I was driving my truck. So it's just fun. I just enjoy it.
You opened up an educational center as well for girls named Mookie's Roses. What was the inspiration behind opening up that education center?
I got in contact with a gentleman named Thomas Ross, who passed away a week ago. God bless him. And he was he played for the Philadelphia Eagles years ago. And he was in the neighborhood, and he was working in the school system, and he worked at the community center. He was just saying how there's just, the city didn't provide a lot of things he needed to help kids to be more involved in things that were not necessarily in their town, but away. Some of those kids had never been out of the county, you know. So you can only dream if you know what's out there to dream about, you know. And that was a big goal for me. And I knew that because I grew up in a small town called Earhart, South Carolina, population 500. We had no community center, you know. It took me, I was 18 before I left the county. So I understood that. But once I got out and I saw everything that was out there, then I began to dream. I can do that. I could do that. And that's the inspiration behind it. And some kids went up going to medical school, nursing school, and they came back, and it was great. When I was traded and retired and stuff, become very difficult to operate it. So we kind of closed it down after that. So, but it was great while it lasted. It was awesome.
Boy, how rewarding is that to see young people that you helped give a start to come back after such successful lives? You know, you were honored by the Mets in their Hall of Fame in the summer of 97. And on Mookie Wilson Day, I went out to Shea Stadium with some of my buddies, big Mets fans, went out there. And it was a dollar day. It was dollar for hot dogs, dollar for popcorn, dollar for soda that day. And we did a thing where we said, it's only a dollar for hot dogs today. We're going to try to eat a hot dog every inning. I made it until the seventh inning. And then I said, I can't do more than seven Shea Stadium hot dogs. But my buddy got to eighth inning. He couldn't make to nine. But I want you to know that we ate hot dogs every inning in your honor that day.
All right. That's great. I love hot dogs, by the way. I think New York has the best hot dogs in the world.
No doubt.
Hot dogs. But now I love the hot dogs on the streets. No.
Yeah.
Those the best. That's a little hot dog, man. I say, hey, the water might be dirty, but the hot dogs are good.
You might be from South Carolina, but you're speaking like a true New Yorker right there. The water might be dirty, but the hot dogs are really good. You know, my listeners know how much of a fan I am of yours. And about a month ago, I had a delivery at the station. One of my listeners bought me an autographed Mookie Wilson signed jersey to put in my office at the studio. And I said, this is the best gift ever. So my listeners know how much I love you. And I am so thrilled that you were able to spend some time with us on our show. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. And I'm sure I'm speaking for a lot of Mets fans for all of such the wonderful memories and being such a positive ambassador for the organization and that 86 team.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me. You know, I love New York. I'm a South Carolinian, but I love New York. And when I go there, my family has family trip in New York. We have a great, great, great time. And it's just one of the most wonderful places I've ever been. Unlike all the horror stories I heard when I was growing up in New York. I've heard some horror stories, man. But I tell you, I've really enjoyed my time in New York, and I still enjoy it every chance I get. I'm up there. I really, really enjoy it.
And your bond with Mets fans is so close. That must be very rewarding for you as well.
It is. I probably get recognized more in New York than I do at home. You know?
Really?
without a doubt. And it's just one of those great, great things that I think I think that every ball player should be admired in their home base, the fan base. But that comes at a price. And that means there are things you have to do. There are things you have to do to do that. People, the one thing I love about New York, they don't give their affection away. They don't give it away. You got to earn it. You got to earn it, you know. And sometimes it goes farther than just hitting a home run or pitching a shutout. So.
But you earned it. You earned it big time. Mookie Wilson joining us here on New York Accent. Mookie, this was a treasure for me. Thank you so much for spending so much time with us today. I'm truly very grateful that you were able to spend this time with us today.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you enjoy my playing. Now, the next thing I get you to do is enjoy my cooking.
Ooh. Oh, wow. What's the best Mookie Wilson dish?
Oh, my goodness. Man, never ask a chef what his best dish is.
Okay.
Never do that.
You show up at the Wilson household and whatever Mookie is cooking.
Whatever it is, you eat.
That's the next episode. That's the next episode, okay?
Okay.
Mookie, right. Thanks again. Thank you so much.
All right, my pleasure, man.
What an awesome conversation with Mookie Wilson. I learned so much from that interview with him, and he's such a likable, charismatic guy. And as a fan of the Mets myself, and one that kind of grew up with that 86 team being the centerpiece of my sports life, that was so awesome and such a great debut episode of New York Accent. I talk about my fandom for the Mets a lot. I've got a partial season ticket package to Citi Field. And, you know, I love those players from the Mets and that specific 86, 87, 88 team. Those were the teams of my youth that I really felt most close to. And, you know, that happens when you're in your formative years. I was, 7, 8, 9 years old when they were going to the World Series in 86 and then winning the division again in 88. I'm oftentimes asked by listeners of my show, which is on the weekday mornings on CBS Sports Radio, nationally syndicated, who my favorite Mets player of those teams was. And, you know, the classics, you love Hernandez, loved Gary Carter. Clearly Mookie Wilson was a fan favorite as well, but my guy on those teams was always Straw. Darryl Strawberry was the guy. You know, I was always so fascinated by the high leg kick and the speed and the power of his bat and the fact that there was a strawberry patch in right field that the groundskeepers had kept, and just the power that Darryl Strawberry created when you're a young fan of the game was just incredibly enticing and magnetic. And Straw was the guy. I had the Darryl Strawberry high kick poster on my bedroom wall. And when he left for the Dodgers in free agency in 90, I was just absolutely crushed. I didn't know how that even could be possible. Strawberry is leaving the Mets for the Dodgers. So it would be Straw, as much as so many of those guys were so much fun and you love them. To this day, Straw still my favorite Met from the 86 Mets and one of my favorite baseball players and really athletes of all time. Every week here on the show after our episodes, you can let us know what you thought about the episode, if you have any thoughts about the interview or people you'd like to see us interview as well. So here's the email to use, nyaccentpod@gmail.com. NYAccent, like New York Accent, nyaccentpod@gmail.com. Email me any thoughts on the podcast and people you'd like to see us interview, and I'd love to hear and I'll read those coming up at the end of all of our episodes as well. So I would love the feedback. You could also hit me up on any of my social accounts, specifically Twitter and Instagram. I check pretty constantly. Just use the hashtag NYAccent and let me know what you think or who you want us to have on the show. On Twitter, it's @DA on CBS. @DA on CBS or on Instagram @DamonAmendo. And I go through my DMs relatively regularly on Instagram, so you can hit me up there as well. All right, that was episode 1 of New York Accent. We are off and running. Can't wait for episode 2, a surprise guest coming up. Remember to subscribe by just searching New York Accent on your podcast and hitting subscribe. It's free, it's great. And if you could leave a review, that's great as well. That helps other people find it if you rate it and review it. All right. Thanks so much. That was episode 1. We'll do it again next Tuesday.
Odyssey is giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor. Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app.
Thanks to Republic Records.
This is a national contest.